Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahat ben Levi Vidatan va'aviram b'nei Eliyav va'on ben Pelet b'nei Reuven. OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Korach, which is doubling this week with Rosh Chodesh Tammuz. Rosh Chodesh Tammuz, 2 days, Shabbat and Sunday. Sunday is the actual first day of the month of Tammuz. Shabbat is the 30th day of the month of Sivan. That makes today, recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 28th of Sivan, 5770, and on the secular calendar, June 10th. Got that? To review for those who are not familiar with it, whenever Rosh Chodesh and Shabbat coincide, the practice is to take out 2 Torah scrolls, read the weekly portion in the first, and then a special maftir in the second for Rosh Chodesh, actually for Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh, followed by a haftarah, not the one for the weekly sedra, that gets preempted by a special haftarah for Rosh Chodesh, for Shabbat Rosh Chodesh. So too the musaf changes into a musaf for combined Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh, not just for Shabbat. And in the other prayers, Arvit, the night before, Shacharit, and Mincha, Ya'aleh V'Yavo for Rosh Chodesh is added to the regular Amidah. It's only the Musaf Amidah that's very noticeably different because of the addition of Rosh Chodesh. And as I said, 2 Torah scrolls, and we'll see what else we discuss. In the meantime, today, we still say Tachanun, and therefore we will say Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli, Tehiena Aznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Yah Adonai Miya Amod, Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam ubein bayabasha ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha u'meafela l'ora ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב, ונאמר אמן. The lead tidbit in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits this week departed from the usual focus on the weekly portion to the events of the flotilla. I don't think I was being too subtle when the title of the lead tidbit is called Floating a Few Ideas. I should have been even more direct than say a flotilla of ideas, because these are things really to discuss, and I did not want to do this show without a reference to it, even though I'm not going to dwell upon it. One of the things that I just made a couple of personal statements that anyone in any sovereign country has to support its government's policy of protecting itself, protecting the country, protecting its citizens, and if that includes a naval blockade in the Mediterranean coast, which includes the Gaza coast, so be it. It seems further so obvious that this was not about humanitarian aid, proof of which Israel offered to have the ships offloaded in Ashdod or Ashkelon port and have the material trucked into to Gaza after suitable inspection, and that was rejected. So it obviously was meant to be confrontational, and I am proud that Israel did not buckle to pressure it must have been under and went ahead with the confrontation. I am also proud but saddened at the fact that Israel goes so far in attempting to minimize harm, injury, and death when at all possible, and they did that by boarding the ships without live ammunition in their rifles but with paint bullets. And they were met by an obviously hired team of thugs who took advantage of the situation and put our soldiers in danger. This, in turn, resulted in the loss of life, which I don't think Israel has anything to be blamed for or to be ashamed of. I think they handled themselves over and above. Perhaps the intelligence could have been a little bit more extensive, and maybe they would have known or figured out that something like this could happen. But that's at least my reaction. What this led me to was a discussion, a presentation of a partnership that exists between God and the Jewish people as far as our defense is concerned. Briefly, I mentioned that when we first came out of Egypt, and we saw the Egyptians' elite army following us, pursuing us, we called to God, and he said, "Don't scream, just stand by. I'll take care of the situation. You just watch." And that was not a precedent. That was an exception to the rule. We were fresh out of Egypt, not yet able to join in with God in our fights. And he treated us that first time to the miracles of the splitting of the sea and the drowning of the Egyptians, where he took the entire battle to himself. Shortly after that, we were encountered by Amalek, and now we see the way the partnership develops between God and the people of Israel. Because God told Moshe to say, to gather an army, to command Yehoshua to draft an army to fight against Amalek with God together, so to speak, and that became the precedent setter. All battles of Israel should be with God's very, very strong help and support, and with a hefty participation on our part. And that's the way it had been throughout Jewish history, and that's the way it continues to be in the modern state of Israel, with Tzava Haganah L'Yisrael, Tzahal, the Israel Defense Forces, IDF, where God could certainly do the job by himself, but he chooses to partner with us. There's one incident coming up in the Torah in a couple of weeks, where God took it all by himself again and then told us about it. And that was the attempt on our nation's life, so to speak, by Balak and Bilam, where God took care of that on his own. And as I said, we only read about it in the Torah, but the norm is that we, finite and imperfect as we are, partner with God in the battles against the people of Israel's enemies. So we all should have that attitude towards IDF. Doesn't mean every situation is perfect, but it means in principle we look to this Jewish army, which won't go into the whole thing now, but we look to the Jewish army, the Israeli army, as very much in line with how God wants us to behave, and that when we have battles, for whatever reasons there are and other factors there are, we fight side by side with God again, so to speak. I think enough said for now, and you could read more in Torah Tidbits, and hopefully you will have your own discussions around your own Shabbat tables, and we'll take it from there. What I would like to do now is share a mini shiur that I gave the folders just a short time ago. It's fresh, it's pre-recorded, but so is this show, and it's long. I don't know how much of it I'll get on, but it's about Parshat Korach from a few different angles. So here it is. I hope you follow and enjoy. Okay, let's see if we could cover a few topics. First of all, Korach. Korach's rebellion follows a statement that already was made in last week's Sedra of 10 times that we angered God in the Midbar. So it always puzzled me as to 10 is that full number, as if God says, enough already, finished. And then the next thing you learn about is Korach's rebellion. However, there are commentaries who say that the rebellion occurred earlier than Chet HaMeraglim, and it finds its way here for a different reason, which I will discuss in a moment. Now, this just let me touch upon a general issue. There is a concept which not all commentaries subscribe to called Ein Seder Mukdam Umu'uchar BaTorah. The Torah does not necessarily go in chronological order. Every time that it does, then you have no question. Why is this here? It's here because it happened after what was last time and what's before next time. But sometimes there's a glaring question of what's this doing right here? It doesn't seem to be in the right place. For example, Yitro visits Moshe in the Midbar, bringing with him Zipporah and the two sons. Now, we are taught it before the episodes of Matan Torah. Yet it is kind of obvious, I was about to say crystal clear, but it's not. It's kind of obvious that at least part of what Yitro recommended to Moshe could only have taken place after we received the Torah and after Parshat Mishpatim with all of the civil law, because that's when Moshe became the judge that he had to answer questions all the time, and Yitro suggested maybe you shouldn't answer everything by yourself, get the help. It doesn't fit before Matan Torah. Therefore, the commentaries who subscribe to this Ein Seder Mukdam Umu'uchar BaTorah, there's not a chronological order always, do believe that every time there is not a chronological order, you're entitled to ask, what's it doing here? And usually they come up with a very nice reason why the Torah would tell us, for example, about Yitro's visit before Matan Torah when it happened after. Let's not get into that, because that's a topic for a different Sedra. But here's the question also. According to some of the Mefarshim, Korach's rebellion happened after the sin of the spies. End of story. That's what it's doing in Parshat Korach, which follows Parshat Shlach, which had Chet HaMeraglim. So there's no No question. In fact, those who subscribe to that, like the Ramban, say that it was the disenchantment on the part of the people. I don't know if that's a good word. It might be worse than that. The despondency of the people with the decree that followed the sin of the spies, that the adult male population would die out over the next years of wandering in the wilderness, that made it very ripe for Korach to gather his gang and to come up with a better suggestion. In other words, a rebellion thinks it has a better chance of success when the people are upset with the ruling government. So there is a certain logic to say it happened right then. The commentaries do say that Korach's disenchantment with his lack of being elevated to a position of authority happened earlier, but he was clever enough to bide his time, because earlier would have meant when Moshe was loved and popular and everything like that, and then you don't go and you challenge his authority. But right at that point where the people are so afraid of what's going to happen, comes Korach and 250 men and other people, and he gets support from Shevet Reuven, and it became ripe to challenge the authority at this point. I could go in more about that, but I'd like to move on to another issue, which comes up in the second part of the Sedra. We have examples here in both Shlach and in Korach of a major story and then a set of mitzvot that reflect the story, as I said on the shiur this past Monday. So I want to focus in on something that's introduced, not for the first time, but it's presented in Parshat Korach, and that is Pidyon HaBen and the other two forms of firstborn, namely the firstborn of a domesticated farm animal, kosher animal, and the firstborn of a donkey. Let's take a step back. The prominence of firstborn goes all the way back to the beginning. The first clash that you had between Cain and Hevel, Cain and Abel, was related to the fact that Cain was the elder and Abel's offering was accepted by God and Cain's wasn't. And I believe that had Hevel been born first and then Cain, Cain would not have been as upset as he was with what happened. But leave that. You have the whole book of Bereshit, which is not a favorable presentation of firstborns. Yishmael loses out to Yitzchak, and Yaakov wins over Esav, and Reuven is removed from that position. In fact, in Korach, the fact that the first pasuk already tells us, Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kat ben Levi v'datan v'aviram b'nei Eliav and On ben Pelet, I'll mention him in a moment, b'nei Reuven. Now, you look at what happens. Korach is the only one with a legitimate gripe. He was a Levi. He was a prominent Levi. He should have, or he felt, he should have been chosen, not so much for Kohen Gadol, although they say that was one of his complaints also, that he accused Moshe of appointing his brother nepotism rather than at God's command. But really, he didn't have that claim, because Aaron's father was Amram, and Amram was the older brother of Yitzhar, who was Korach's father. What he did have a claim to was the leadership of the family unit of Kahat, which went to El Tzafon ben Uziel, who was the youngest brother of Amram. And that means that Korach was literally passed over in order to find a leader from the family unit. And that seems to be what the commentaries say was what started him on his path to rebellion. The fact that he found allies among Reuven was a natural, the commentaries explain, because Reuven was triply passed over by Levi, by Yehuda, and by Yosef. The kingship ends up to Yehuda, and it's not only in the future, in Yaakov's bracha. The bracha to Yehuda was that of leadership, not Reuven. The bracha to Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Yosef, was the double portion that Reuven thought he was entitled to, and the Kahuna and Leviah, which went to Levi, and Reuven got triple whammied in that, and therefore the people of Reuven, who camped next to the family unit of Kahat, which meant Korach had a short walk across the street to find his ripe audience among the people. And Datan Vaviram probably did not need any reason to get after Moshe Rabbeinu. They've been doing it for a long time. In fact, you could ask, what are they still doing around at this time? And, you know, that's trying to second-guess God, so we won't. The own Ben Pellet is an interesting side point, because he never shows up again after his mention in the first pasuk. And the commentaries say that his wife dissuaded him from joining Korach's rebellion. And the commentaries don't even ascribe good motives for what she did, but nonetheless they give her credit for saving his life. How much more so when a wife will put herself out for the proper motives to advance her spouse. But
what did they think some of the motives were?
She said to him, you're siding with Korach. You're not from the family of Levi, so even if Korach wins, you can't be appointed a Kohen or a Levi anyway, so why do it? And however she prevented him from joining, she did. But the fact is, the Torah makes a point. Before I continue with Bechor, let me backtrack one step. This business of Ein Seder Mukdam U'Muchar Batorah is very, very important, because whenever you don't have a natural reason for something being taught to us where it is, then you have to say the Torah put it there to teach us something special. The Torah could have easily arranged and organized all events in their chronological order. When it departs from that, when it puts things next to something else, and when it puts Korach rebellion right next to the immediate last issue of Chet HaMeraglim, then you're talking two different types of rebellion, but they don't learn their lesson kind of thing. We'll be right back. Hi, you are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Korach. We're in the middle, sort of a mini-shir I gave the Torah Tidbits folders earlier today, and I would like to continue with that now. When it departs from that, when it puts things next to something else, and when it puts Korach rebellion right next to the immediate last issue of Miriam, I'm sorry, that's the week before, we'll skip that, after the whole Chet HaMeraglim business, then you're talking two different types of rebellion, but they don't learn their lesson kind of thing. Anyway, let me move on to Bechor. Until Yetziat Mitzrayim, we don't have, other than the natural human tendency to honor the firstborns, and we then have a religious reason, so to speak, where God said he has designated the firstborns as holy from the day he saved the Jewish firstborns from Makat Bechorot, the smiting of the firstborns of the Egyptians, and he sanctified them. But it's more than that. This idea of first issue, first fruit, Truma, which is the first portion of produce, are dedicated to God on some level, as if to say, I have no right to eat from my crops until I first take care of Truma. I have no right to benefit from the wool of my sheep unless I give the first shearing as a gift to the Kohen. I can't bake my own dough into bread until I first take challah and give it And all of these firsts add up to that picture.
All this is connected with the... How is this connected?
It's not. It's connected in the fact that the rules in Parshat Korach after his rebellion are about Kohanim, Levim doing their job, Kohanim doing their job, obligations of Yisraelim. In other words, Korach was advocating a homogenization. Let's homogenize the Jewish people. We're all holy. We're all equal. And the Torah is setting down a different, you'll read Rabbi Weinreb's article in Torah Tidbits, you'll see what he says about it. But you see that it's not all equal. A Kohen has a certain status, and a Levi has a different status, and Israel has a status, and each one has its things to do and its obligations, and its pros and cons. It's the Yisraelim that received land in Eretz Yisrael to settle, and the Kohanim and the Levim were only given cities to live in, but it was not their private possessions like land is, and yet theirs was the service of God. And the fact of the matter is that the mitzvot in Korach spell out not what Korach thinks. You're not all equal. There are Kohanim. There are Levim that have obligations to Kohanim and to the Beit HaMikdash. There are Yisraelim that have obligations to the Kohanim and to the Levim. And you have to be careful because these lines are drawn. Bein Hayeter, inter alia, as they say in some language. Bein Hayeter works fine, if you know that. You have Bechor. Bechor, specifically, three types, so let's briefly go over those three types. You have a Bechor of the firstborn male. That doesn't mean the firstborn male. It means if the firstborn is male, then the animal, be it a calf, a lamb, or a kid, is sacred and must be taken care of for the first 30 days or 50 days in the case of a calf, and then given as a gift to the Kohen of your choice. That Kohen who receives the Bechor is not allowed to refuse it. It's one of the gifts of the Bechor of a Kohen. And he has to bring it as a korban in the Beit HaMikdash, the korban called by the catchy name Bechor. And he has to bring it within the first year of the animal's life. He may not sell the animal. He may not slaughter it for his own personal use. He may not let it survive and grow and work it or anything like that. It is sacred, cannot be redeemed. If he attempts to redeem it or exchange it for another animal, A, it doesn't work, the animal is still sacred. B, the animal he attempted to exchange with it becomes sacred also. And C, he's liable to punishment for attempting to remove the sanctity of a Bechor. Now, briefly, in our time, where we don't have a Beit HaMikdash for the Kohen to bring the Bechor as a korban, as a sacrifice, the Shulchan Aruch says, get out of this mitzvah. Because this mitzvah applies today. I've told you this before in this forum. Just picture the situation. A person owns a cow. The cow is pregnant for her first time. When the calf is born, if it's a male, it is kodesh. It is sacred. Whether the person says so or not, whether he wants it to be or not. And this applies today. 5770, in the year 2010, if a Jew owns a cow, female sheep, or female goat, and they have a first offspring which is male, that animal is kodesh. The person is obligated today to take care of it for 30 or 50 days and give it to a Kohen. The Kohen is not allowed to refuse it. And then the Kohen is stuck. He is stuck. I'll tell you. Too bad. He is stuck with it. He has to take care of it until there's a Beit HaMikdash to be able to bring it as a korban. And if it lives Bishunut and Tzfansik, or whatever the equivalent of those animals are. He buries the carcass when it dies of natural causes without ever benefiting from it. Therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says, don't do that, get out of it. And the Shulchan Aruch says, I'll tell you how to do it. It's kind of easy. Your cow is pregnant for her first time. Go to a non-Jew. Say, I want you to buy a share in my cow. Give me a shekel, and you will own a tenth of a percent of my cow. He gives you a shekel. The cow is now jointly owned by a Jew and a non-Jew. The fact that the Jew has 99.9% ownership doesn't make a difference. The guy only has a tenth of a percent. It's a joint ownership. Joint ownership on the animal. When the animal gives birth, no sanctity. No requirements. It is a regular animal and the owner does what he wants with it. But listen again. The mitzvah applies today. I like saying that because we think in terms of connected to the Beit HaMikdash, connected to a korban. So what do you mean it applies today? The mitzvah and what you do with it are separate things. The mitzvah applies, and Shulchan Aruch says, get out of it. It is forbidden, and you have a point, because it is forbidden to eat from that. So if today someone would not do this properly, and let a bechor get into the market, we could be eating from that meat without knowing that it was forbidden, and there is no bitul on it. We wouldn't be held accountable because we wouldn't know. But there is such a thing as this procedure being seen to by those kibbutzim and other places where they raise animals. Let's move on. A firstborn donkey is not kodesh because a non-kosher animal can't have kedusha. But because it's a firstborn donkey, only donkey, there is no other animal that this applies to, the owner cannot do anything with it. It's not his yet. It belongs to God, so to speak, until he redeems it. And he redeems it by giving a sheep or the equivalent monetary value of a sheep to a Kohen of his choice in exchange for that firstborn donkey. This mitzvah applies in our time, and this mitzvah has no reason not to be performed. Because since there's no need for the Beit HaMikdash or for the Mizbeach, and there's no Kedusha problem, then the Shulchan Aruch says, remember what I told you about getting out of that other mitzvah? Don't do it. It'll work if you do it. And all you'll be doing is saving yourself however much a sheep costs, but it's wrong. Because it's a mitzvah to perform, and it is performed today in our time. There are places around this country every so often have a pidyon peter chamor. Wow. Next we come to the firstborn of a human being. As you know, a firstborn of a human being, if both father and mother are not from Kohen or Levi, on their father's side, in other words, if neither grandfather of the firstborn baby is a Kohen or a Levi, then that baby must be redeemed by his father from a Kohen. Even though in the ceremony of Pidyon HaBen, the Kohen says to the father in Aramaic, which would you prefer, this, your firstborn, or these five silver coins? And you have wise guy fathers who say, oh, give me a moment, I'm thinking. It isn't a choice. A father can say, I would rather keep the money and you keep the kid. It has no effect. Pidyon HaBen is an obligation. If a father does not perform it, it must be done by the child himself when he gets older. And it happens quite, I can't say all the time, but it happens. You know when it happens? When a 18, 19-year-old boy goes to yeshiva and he's a baal tshuva, and he learns this, and he goes back to his parents who are not religious and said, did I ever have a pidyon haben? And they say, a pidyon what? So they do a little checking in the family, and sometimes they say, oh, yeah, you know, your uncle so-and-so said that we did do a Pidyon HaBen. I didn't remember it or whatever. Or sometimes they say, no, we don't think it was done. Then this boy has the privilege of being podeh et atzmo, redeeming himself, and it's a very exciting thing. He goes to a kohen, and he says, I am a bechor, firstborn of a Jewish woman, and I never had a pidyon haben when I was little, and I would like to redeem myself. So he gives the 5 silver coins to the kohen. They do this with the presence of a minion and a party, and it's a nice thing. Yeshiva University, we always had guys like that, each year, one or two.
My husband has been that.
Yeah. And it's a big thing, you know. They invite their friends, and they have a party. If a person had a Pidyon HaBen, but didn't need to have a Pidyon HaBen, then if the Kohen is a nice guy, he'll return the money, because it's not really his. But there's nothing, you know, worse. The worst thing is, it was a bracha levatala. You know, when they made a bracha on it, which you can't take back. Now, let me go a little more on this, because there's an outside point that I want to make to generalize, not just on this issue of bechor. You have here 3 levels of bechor, where in the case of the animal, you have absolutely no choice. The animal is kodesh, and you can't redeem it, and you can't exchange it. The donkey, in the case of the human, we somehow built into the ceremony offering a choice, but it really isn't a choice. And in the case of the donkey, it really is a choice, because the Torah gives an alternative to redeeming a firstborn donkey. It is not a pleasant alternative, but it is still one of the 613 mitzvot that if a person who owns a donkey, who has a firstborn and it's a male, and does not want to give up a sheep or the money value of a sheep, he'd rather get rid of the donkey, he has to destroy the donkey. Now, the image in your mind of a cute little baby donkey wearing a sombrero and saying, quick draw, I think I have a, you know, thing. Remember him? Anyone remember his name? No, his donkey friend. Baba Louie. Baba Louie. Okay. But the Torah says, if you don't redeem, you have to give him arifa. Arifa is a chop with a knife on the back of the neck that destroys it. And you just bury the carcass, because no benefit can come from it. Now, there is ample source material to say this was not choose one or the other. This was redeem that donkey. But bottom line is, if you refuse to do it, and if you don't want to do it, you have to know you may not derive any benefit from that baby donkey, and it has to be destroyed. There is, as I said, a suggestion that it's not a preferred alternative. And by the way, train of thought to a totally different issue. There's another example in the Torah, Lahavdil, but it's there, where you have 2 possibilities of handling a situation. One is the preferred, and the other the not so preferred. But when times changed, the not-so-preferred became the way to go. What am I talking about? Yibum and Chalitza. A man dies without offspring. His wife either marries his brother in Yibum, or they sever the relationship with Chalitza. In the time when Yibum was practiced, that was the preferred thing to do. How do you know? You look at the ceremony of Chalitza, and it's basically a reproach to the man. It's saying to him, you refused to uphold your brother's name in Israel. We spit before you, we remove your shoe and throw it down, and you did a not nice thing. So Chalitza was always an alternative, but a much less preferred option than Yibum. Once Yibum was banned by rabbinic decree, then, hello, Chalitza became the option of choice. It is no longer derogatory to the man, although the ceremony still remains the same. But you're saying things that don't have that same negative punch to them, because he didn't refuse to carry his brother's name in Israel. He can't, by rabbinic decree. Okay, we're back live, which means for this, recorded once, not twice. and I had stopped the recording at that point because someone's cell phone went off, and we digressed, and I don't even think I got back to making the point that I wanted to in the first place. So I'll do that now. There are many mitzvot, commands in the Torah, both positive and prohibitions, that are specific, and there's one way to observe them, and if you don't, then you're in violation. But then there are some examples where we have a choice, and there is a recommendation as to which choice to take, and we are supposed to not only behave in the black and white situations correctly, but even when there is a choice between two alternatives, we are supposed to sense or get advice as to which option is the preferred one, which, if you put it like this, would God rather we do? I don't know how that sounds, but it's the same idea no matter how I would put it, where sometimes the Torah does give you an option, and yet you realize it's not there. Now, this all started with the Bechor business, and basically there is no option when it comes to redeeming a firstborn. You either redeem him or you don't, in which case you're in violation, and in which case, as I expressed earlier, the boy has to do it himself. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about more like the firstborn donkey options, or like the Yibum example, or whatever. It was just something that I drew from the Sedra of Korach. It is treated elsewhere in the Torah, and by the way, that's a point as well. The fact that Bechor has been introduced to us since Parshat Bo, and in various other places in the Torah, and in fact would not need at all to be mentioned in Parshat Korach, except for the Kohen and ruler leadership issues that Korach was rebelling against, and all of the laws that are presented in the rest of Parshat Korach relate to who's in charge and whose tasks are what. And even the fact that one of the prohibitions is that a Levi can't do a Kohen's task, but a Kohen can't do a Levi's task either. And Yisrael can't do the tasks of either of those. On that note, let me add something that I found fascinating. Temple function is basically in the hands of the Kohanim with the support of the Leviim, but a non-Kohen, non-Levi is essential to the process. A person representing the population at large, and specifically the area of the country whose Kohanim and Leviim are on duty in a particular week, a representative from the non-Kohen, non-Levi community, is in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, each morning, different person, and he is the one that gives instructions to the Kohanim to proceed with their daily tasks as soon as the sun rises. Without this non-Kohen, non-Levi saying, go to it, guys, they can't function, because it's a partnership arrangement. And that's something that Korach and his ilk do not want to accept, and that's something that is very much entrenched in Jewish life and practice, and we have to relate the details to, or put the background of Korach's rebellion to some of these details to give them a little punch. Let me finish off on a thought that I've shared in the past, and it happens to come to mind every time we have a Shabbat and a Rosh Chodesh coinciding, which is a couple of times a year. Shabbat represents the sanctity of time. Rosh Chodesh represents the sanctity of time. The difference between the two is that Shabbat's sanctity of time came exclusively from God. He created the world, and he rested on the seventh day, Al Kain. Therefore, God blessed the seventh day and made it holy. Rosh Chodesh's sanctity comes from us. The Jewish people were entrusted by God, instructed, commanded by God, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, this month is yours. You are the ones that are in charge of proclaiming Rosh Chodesh and the sanctity of it, and all of the holidays that fall out in any given month are based upon the act of sanctification of time on our part. God showed us how He does it and then commanded us to be active partners in the process of sanctification of time. And therefore, Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh, when they coincide, give us a fuller picture of this concept, and it behooves us to think about it, ponder it, relate to it, talk about it, and enjoy it. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameach.